So our guest today is, and I've already been warned off of this, but it's Dr. Paul Jones, but we're just going to call him Paul. That's his preference, his request. So, Paul, when I was first told about you, you were described to me as a professor of Abrahamic religions. Does that adequately describe what you do for a living?
The professor part, I get paid to talk, so that's good. I do primarily Judaism and Christianity.
Okay.
I have a colleague who is Muslim who teaches Islam. So I would not put myself in the category of Abrahamic in the sense of the three
sure.
traditional monotheistic religions. But I dabble, obviously, a little bit in Islam in the sense of I try to understand it, particularly in light of 2001. But primarily, I would argue that what I pretend to know and espouse is usually anchored in Judaism and Christianity.
So those are the bumpers you bowl between then? Okay.
That's what my bumper sticker says.
Gotcha.
And I'm not at this point eager to remove them from that.
Gotcha. So between Judaism and Christianity, do you feel you have a strong point between those two? Is there one that you lean more heavily towards or feel more invested in?
Yeah, I am Christian. I grew up in a parsonage. My father, I'm a PK. Father was a minister. I thought I was Jesus for at least 2 or 3 minutes. So I have more affinity toward Christianity.
Correct.
My formative years, I can date myself what we call the Wonder Bread years, you know,
okay.
the first 12 years.
Sure.
I lived part of that time in St. Louis for 8 years and in University City, for those of you that may know St. Louis. And my immediate neighbors across the street were Catholic, and so we had that conversation. And then I had other neighbors who were Jewish, and every Saturday people would be walking down the street going to synagogue. And I was always curious as to why Saturday and why are they walking. And so my curiosity about Judaism was spawned at an early age. And then, obviously, if one is serious about studying Christianity, one needs to recognize that last time I checked, Jesus was Jewish, and he still is.
Pretty important part of the equation there.
I think so. I don't want to be too contentious, but yeah, I would say that in order to understand who Jesus is as a person, whether one is looking at him from a so-called neutral perspective or a biased perspective, one has to recognize that he understood himself to be Jewish. He kind of did Jewish things. And therefore, you have to read Jesus with Jewish eyes.
Gotcha. So prior to this conversation, I read some of your work to try and get a sense of kind of where your head was at and where you were coming from. One of the things I picked up on is a lot of people who write about Christianity who may, and I'm not calling you this, but people who would call themselves apologists maybe,
right.
will necessarily, understandably, kind of build fences around some parts of the religion and say, we can talk about this, we can debate this, but here are the parts that I'm kind of not willing to question. This is where your questions aren't allowed to go. And I got a sense from reading your stuff that you don't necessarily have those fences. Is that accurate? Would you say the entire everything about Christianity is open to question for you?
Yes.
That was a long question and a short answer. That was good.
I practice. Would you like me to elaborate?
Please do.
Oh, please. Okay. It wasn't that way always.
Sure.
As I say, I grew up in a parsonage. I'm cradle to, I'm not quite in the grave yet, maybe one toenail. So I've been part of the Christian tradition, and there are individuals and churches that clearly are reluctant to have people bore down, if you will, drill down to what you and I might consider to be core principles, convictions, commitments, doctrinal statements. And I think all of us, at one point, if we're honest, recognize that we move through stages of development, both as humans but also as religious persons. And at some points, we are much more concrete in terms of how we read, interpret, and wish. That is, I think, the, what should we say, The instinct for certainty is alive and well in all human beings by definition, and that sometimes it's difficult to kind of let go. And that happened for me primarily when I went to college. I lived in not isolated areas, but ones that were not quite as free-spirited or progressive. And therefore, college for me in the 60s in particular, with the Vietnam War on the international scene and civil rights on the domestic scene, a time of sincere, deep questioning, both culturally and religiously. And I got caught up in that kind of maelstrom, and it rocked my boat.
Yeah.
And that was the best thing that ever happened to me. It was painful as hell. And,
sure.
You know, but in terms of the larger journey, it was necessary. That is, I had a set of inherited beliefs, but I had not actually owned them for myself. And so this period forced me to say, okay, what of this do I want to adhere to and uphold and perhaps even possess? And what parts of this do I need to jettison? And how do I make those decisions and all that kind of stuff? So that started the process where I'm still trying to figure the thing out.
And that's
ongoing. It's pilgrimage. It's a journey in faith.
That's a really hard process, like you said. You mentioned that it was painful. And ultimately, hopefully, it's a process that everybody goes through. You know, psychologists would say that that's part of growing up, where you hold what your parents taught you in one hand and you say, is this theirs or is this mine?
Right.
And you put it in the keep pile or the throwaway pile.
Right.
And so that's really hard. Do you remember, was there a particular moment or a particular author or something where you were just like, where you started to see the cracks in the facade that you remember? And it's fine if there's not. That's a gradual process for a lot of people.
Yeah, it is a gradual process. I'll just tell you a little episode. When I was a freshman in college, William Stone Coffin was my campus minister chaplain. And he is deceased, but he was a very prominent activist opposing the war. Incredible person. He's written several books and well worth reading even today. Well, he brought on campus a person by the name of Malcolm Boyd, an Episcopal priest, who wrote a very important book back in the mid-60s called Are You Running With Me, Jesus? So he was introduced. I was in chapel. I didn't go to services very often. But he was in chapel one day when I happened to be there, and Bill introduced him, and I'll never forget what he said. He said, Malcolm Boyd, and he gave all the accolades, and then he said he gestured with his hand up to his neck. He's up to here with religion, but can't kick the habit. And so that was an acknowledgement that one could be inside the tradition without grasping it in terms of literally containing it and clutching it. One could let go of it, and you could be free enough to say, you know, I'm still wrestling with this. I'm still struggling. I'm still trying to figure this out. And eventually it dawned on me that one of the worst things that we do in religion is that we treat them as quantifiable terms, so that religion or faith or belief are categories that are static. And so we treat them all as nouns. But in terms of theological tradition, I would want to argue that they're verbs. And therefore they're dynamic by definition. In the same way that I have a coat at home that my mother bought me when I was 13 years old, and I still, quote, am growing into it. The sleeves are too long for me, but I still use it, you know, working in the yard. But my mother anticipated that my arm and my body would grow. That is, as a child, one has to change clothes, you have to go to the store, you have to keep eating, you do all these natural things that are biologically necessary for what we call physiological growth. Well, the same thing is true for our spiritual and religious growth. And so all of us, I recognized when I was a first year at school that Malcolm Boyd, obviously, was still wrestling with these issues, and that this is a dynamic process as opposed to static. So we're not here to say all of our beliefs are like little gold nuggets, and we build a Fort Knox, and we, you know, literally have a barrier that keeps us from the world. I think the best example in religion, in Catholicism, is is John the 23rd, when he was talking to a reporter about the beginning and the purpose of Vatican II. He went to the window and opened up the window and said, in Italian, agli ornamento, that is, he wanted to let some fresh air in. Well, most of us like fresh air.
Yeah.
Now, fresh air can create its own complications, particularly if it's not only fresh, but a little windy. So, you know, so there are complications with that. But the reality is religion breathes. Religion, it has to be situated. Religion lives inside of a cultural context. And so by definition, as time changes, as our historical context change, as we change as human beings, hopefully mature, and add new experiences to our perspective, so in some sense, religion has to do that. Religion, the problem with religion is when you codify it, when you create artifacts and you create religion as items, when you start quantifying like that, what you do is that you strip religion of its dynamism, of its relevance, because it has to be permanent and fixed, because it has to be certain. It's the foundation. If you have cracks in the foundation, as you've already alluded to, then one feels, obviously, anxiety.
Yeah.
And angst, and eventually crisis of faith. Well, it's not really so much a crisis of faith as a crisis of belief.
Sure.
And those two terms, for me, have to be distinguished and separated, so that if I understand to be a Christian, I have to have faith or belief in Jesus' resurrection or Jesus' miracles or something like that, I've created then essentially a mathematical formula. So Christianity equals belief in a physical resurrection. So if I tamper with anything on one side of the equation, by definition, it's no longer
the whole thing.
Yeah, the whole thing collapses in. You know, it's a domino theory. It's like when you were a kid, you walked around the grocery store back when I did, when you had these pyramid of cans. And, of course, you couldn't reach the top can when Mom said, go get me a can of soup. You take the middle one, and, of course, the whole bloody pyramid fell down. And, of course, that's the problem when you start equating one's understanding of God or Jesus or whatever your tradition is espousing as if those are quantifiable statements.
Let me pull from something you said there. You're talking about the necessity of religion to be able to change.
Sure.
And so what you're teaching Judaism and Christianity, and you can correct me on this if I misspeak here, my understanding is Judaism has kind of developed in a way that it is a little more open to change. That you can look at something like they have the Midrash, where they're very open to interpretation. And Christianity seems to have insulated itself a little bit. Do you think there is room for Christianity to develop more of a Jewish point of view when it comes to development and change of tenets?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I've got a lot of things going on in my head. So let me try to distill that down to several points, and we can decide where we want to go.
Okay.
For Christianity, the so-called structure of Christianity, in some sense, focuses on Jesus is the Christ. So it's a theological belief statement. Judaism isn't about that. Clearly, there are theological, but they're not systematic in the same way that Christians are, because the way in which they understand. So what I tell students and what I try to remind myself is that the most important concept for Judaism is people, peoplehood. So once you begin with that kind of core principle and kind of core axis around which everything else revolves, then you begin to see, well, human beings grow and change. Therefore, my thought process can grow. As my rabbi friends tell me, obviously, whenever two or three Jews are gathered, you're probably going to have 5 or 10 different opinions. And again, Midrash is part of it. Reading the Gospels, in some sense, we need to think of those as Midrash as well. So that's immensely important that Christianity has, made some miscalculations in their historical evolution. And let me give an example then to back up what I've just said. Most Christians, whether you're part of a non-creedal church or not, obviously the Orthodox Church, meaning Greek or Armenian or Russian Orthodox, and the Catholic, Roman Catholic Church, use creeds on a regular basis. Lutherans and others, Presbyterians. So there are mainstream Protestants that do as well. But there are a lot of people who don't adhere to creeds per se. Creeds then are the way in which the church decided to circumscribe acceptable, appropriate, we might say legitimate, language yeah. about God, Jesus, church, Holy Spirit. So that has been the inherited memory of the church from the 4th century on. First creed is the Council of Nicaea in 325 once Constantine takes over. What's interesting is that if we assume the Gospels reflect in some way the voice and the message of Jesus, Sermon on the Mount is obviously kind of important. I would argue that Christians shouldn't be putting the Ten Commandments on the on their lawns, although they may. But I would argue you should be putting the Beatitudes or something like that on the lawn. That seems to be closer to the voice of Jesus. But if we notice, whether it be Jesus in terms of what scholars have called kind of the Jesus Manifesto, that is Luke 4, which is the traditional commissioning scene, because in Luke, Jesus is really a prophet. The commissioning scene, he is in the synagogue and he reads from chapter 61 of Isaiah, and it's all about what? Visiting the sick, healing, taking care of the prisoners. It's action. And if you look at Matthew 25, the so-called last judgment scene, what is it about? It's not a test on what you believe about Jesus. Jesus never said anything about belief statements. He never even mentioned resurrection isn't part of his vocabulary. It's kind of strange. So the church in the 4th century does what I would call a U-turn, a 180. U-turn, I guess, isn't a 180. So we'll cancel that. I'm still learning. But they do a 180. Instead of talking about how to live in the world, ethical action in the world, action that reflects love of God and neighbor, the church in the creedal statement, and this is true now for Protestants as well, have fixated on the belief statement and not on the living aspects. So again, a huge change. And I think the living aspect is a way of talking about the Jewish understanding. Tikkun Olam is, what does it mean to be a Jew? It means to heal or repair the world. Therefore, it's an emphasis on what we call orthopraxis. That is, how do I live out my tradition? What's the practice? What are the ethical implications? How do I decide how do I relate to neighbor and to God? And Christianity will talk that way, but Christianity is focused on belief statements. Is Jesus the Christ? Do you believe in the resurrection? Do you believe in the virgin birth? Those are very different statements and move you down radically different paths. And so Christianity has, by definition, I think, modified at best, if not abdicated, what I consider to be the Jewish ethos and milieu within which Jesus lived.
So let me ask you this. So this is the rubber meets the road of this conversation, I
Finally.
Think. We're getting there.
Holy cow. I've been waiting.
So I think, to me, it seems easy to find, and maybe it's the bookstores I'm shopping in, but it's pretty easy to find, I think, a Christian professor or historian who will look at the Old Testament and say, Exodus probably didn't happen.
Yeah.
Abraham probably didn't exist as he's presented in the Bible. Like, there's a lot of devout believers who will say that. But I feel like one of those fences get built a little bit when you get to the New Testament. And I'm not referring
surely,
to you.
Surely you guess.
I'm not referring to you. But they will question historically the Old Testament.
Right.
But when you get to Jesus,
right.
all of a sudden, you can't do that anymore. There is no willingness to question historical,
right.
like the resurrection, the virgin birth, like you said.
Right.
Is that accurate? Why is that?
Yes.
am I basically just saying what you just told me, that it's because of we have put this emphasis on belief? Does the whole thing fall apart without those moments being historic? Yeah. I'm just going to kind of open a field and let you run into it here.
Well, this is a time I should be promoting all my books so that I can retire earlier, right?
Please do. Please do.
No, super question. And it requires more than a few minutes of
sure.
commentary, but let me just run with it for a minute.
If you could do it in a minute, that'd be great.
It would be great. You're right. But it wouldn't be me. So... the watershed event is the Enlightenment, okay? So we're looking at 17th and 18th century after the Renaissance, and all of a sudden there's a rise of historical consciousness, the rise of scientific inquiry, worldview, methodology, where truth is identified with empirical evidence, right?
Right.
So if we take that as kind of the baseline now for modernity, and I'm not talking about post-modernity, I'm just talking about post-Enlightenment times. The issue and the rise of what we call biblical scholarship, looking at the relationship of, quote, faith and history, and then looking at the nature of the texts, we see the beginning of biblical criticism. Criticism is not meant to criticize. It is meant to... It's a process of humility where we try to understand what it is the text meant in the context in which it was written, and then have a dialogue with our contemporary mind and conversation partners, whether it be church, synagogue, or just an interested group of people. So biblical criticism begins to explore the historical evidence for these events and people. And surprise, these biblical scholars, many of them continental and German in particular, started with the Hebrew Bible and started with Genesis and moved forward. And so you still have, it's remarkable how hundreds of years later we're still debating scientific creationism. But there are so that you begin to then question the historicity of Abraham and Moses and going and Joseph and going all the way down. So that archaeology, I'm interested in archaeology, the intersection of archaeology, history, and biblical texts. How do those interplay? How do they inform us? Because really what we're trying to do is strip away our presuppositions that we bring to the text.
Yeah.
So that we can actually open up the text, not in a way in which archaeologists, in some sense, unearth objects from the ground. So we want to unearth, if this is not an appropriate image because it's more dynamic, but not so much truth in the text, but the words of the text. We have to make that distinction because the truth and the text are not to be seen as inanimate objects. Again, they're vibrant too because they were written at a particular time by particular people who had particular assumptions about the world, God, etc. And again, if this dynamic process of change and interpretation is valid, then that trajectory cuts both ways, present as well as past. So the point is there are three major issues now that are being debated. And notice where it starts. Who are the Israelites? That's the first question. Not who is Abraham or Moses, because those are probably composite figures
right.
of people. So you've got who are the Israelites and how do we know it? That is, how can you distinguish? This goes into conquest tradition and that kind of stuff. We can talk about that later if you want to. The other issue that has to do with David and Solomon, there is virtually little evidence. There's big contest right now, and it's contentious and it's emotional in terms of Israel and Palestine, because archaeology is political by definition. And so in the city of David, just below the Dung Gate, in the old city, there's a debate about whether or not this structure has to do with the Palace of David, because we don't have any evidence for that. Only one epigraphic evidence that comes out of Dan, which is way to the north in terms of the House of David. And then the third question has to do with the time period in terms of minimalist theory, but we don't need to go there. So the issue is there was a fencing by the German scholars until the beginning of the 19th century. That is, the fencing was, we can be critical when it comes to the Hebrew Bible because we can lose a few of those guys and still be okay. But Jesus, that's a little more delicate, right?
Yeah.
Kind of coming too close to home, as they say. And so we begin then the search for the historical Jesus in the 19th century. Lessing is a person that frames the conversation for us because he talks about human beings not being able to, if you will, they can't bridge the ugly ditch of history. And so you begin to see the beginning of what we call the first phase. We're now in the third phase of the quest for the historical Jesus. And Strauss starts, and he starts demythologizing, that is, throwing away the supernatural elements of the text, miracles and resurrection. And, of course, somebody by the name of Thomas Jefferson sat in the White House and created the Thomas Jefferson Bible, and particularly the Gospels, where he literally took scissors and cut out all stories that had to do with the supernatural, because he is a product of the Enlightenment, and therefore only things that adhere to what he understands as rational make the cut, if you will. Everything else does get cut. And so that process is fascinating. It's still going on. And the Jesus Seminar, which started in 1985 by Robert Funk, is probably the best example of scholars trying to understand, using critical methodology, using principles of scholarship, using established criteria, trying to decide what perhaps may have been said by Jesus and what perhaps was invented, and I'll use that word, invented by the church. That does not mean Jesus is good, invention by the church is bad. No, what it means is that the church is trying to understand who is Jesus for them. We're a tad late to the conversation, as in like 2,000 years late. So if all we privilege is the voice of Jesus, we've got a problem. Jesus spoke Aramaic. He didn't speak Greek. So the text itself isn't the voice of Jesus.
Right.
This is a very complicated. And which text? We know at least 34 different Gospels and probably 50 or more, right? So why these four? Who's promoting them? Who's writing them? All that kind of stuff. So the point of the exercise is, who is Jesus for them? That is, for the Matthean community, the Johannine community. And that's what we're looking at. If Jesus is resurrected Lord for these followers, then Jesus is present to them. So what does Jesus have to say to them in their particular situation? So if you look at the four canonical Gospels, you will see very different portraits of Jesus. The Jesus of Mark is highly apocalyptic. It looks like the world's coming in because it's probably written just as Jerusalem is literally being destroyed by the Romans and Titus in the year 70 CE. Whereas if you look at Luke, you don't see that at all. He doesn't worry about apocalyptic stuff at all. His understanding of Jesus is his social prophet. So you talk about Luke 4. And so in his role, women is very radical for that time. Who is Jesus for us in our particular situation? And that's the role of the scholar, the teacher, and I would argue anybody that wants to be a follower of Jesus, or even understanding, is that begin to understand this trajectory of interpretation and try to ask yourself the question, who was Jesus for Mark or Matthew or Luke? And now, who is Jesus for us? And so you have to do this combination, and it's a dance. And it requires imagination, not just scholarship. So it's not a static process where you have these little components like students come to class and they fill up my bucket, you know, with information and I walk out. No, it's not fun. We have to have a baseline of understanding and, you know, you have to, well, who is Moses or who is Jesus? So you have to have some information. But the point now becomes, how do you negotiate who this person is? Because you and I come to the text a tad late and we come with radically different assumption about how the world operates. Radically different assumption about what it means to be a Jew. There was no such thing as Christianity. I don't like to use the word Christianity until roughly 150. And so there's a whole trajectory that is required. Now, that does not mean you have to be a biblical scholar to be a follower of Jesus. I want to make sure that's clear. But if you're serious about who is Jesus, you have to be serious to the point of saying, I might be wrong, and therefore I want to be careful and serious and sincere about how I learn how to read this text. When I read the newspaper, I recognize when I read the headlines, when I read the editorials, when I read the one ads, and when I read the sport page, I automatically calculate these are different genres, and therefore I flip my mind. So that when I see literalism on the sports page, somebody went 2 for 3 at the plate, that was a good day. when I go to the one ads and they say this job and call this number, I want to be a literalist. But when I go to the comic page, if I'm literal on the comic page, then I laugh because I see the juxtaposition between the literal and, if you will, the metaphorical.
Gotcha.
And a good comedian does that. We are right now with plenty of material for comedians. That is the juxtaposition between a literal and a metaphorical. And when those clash like that, that's where humor occurs at those edges, at those boundaries.
Yeah.
And the same is true for how we understand who Jesus is.
You're starting to knock on my door in some sense.
Open.
I mentioned the article of yours that I read, and I'm reading the whole thing. I'm enjoying it. And then you get close to the end, and you start to talk about mythology. When I was seeking resources to help me figure out my faith, Joseph Campbell became my guy. I don't know if there is such a thing as a Campbellite, but if there is...
Yeah, actually, I'm a Campbellite because I'm a disciple of Christ, and our founders were Thomas and Alexander Campbell.
Oh, that's all Campbell. A little different, yeah.
I was just pre-associating. plug there for disciples.
Nice. So I would call myself a Campbellite in some sense, a Jungian, because that idea that... These stories seems like a very pedestrian term here, but those stories represent a greater truth.
Yes.
And that when you start to unpack them, you start to figure out things about yourself. And I like a lot of what you're saying there about how who is Jesus to you in that moment? Who was he to Matthew? Who was he to Luke? And even asking, I just finished reading the Gospel of Mary Magdalene and asking, who was he to she? And why when it came time to write a gospel and put her name on it, why was that particular message being told?
Right.
And so I like the idea of Jesus being a little more amorphous a little bit.
Let's play with that for a while. Let me see if I can come up with three nice points. When we talk about Mark's Jesus or Mary Magdalene's Jesus, we're really talking about the community's construction of its image of who. So I want to make sure that when I speak, when I say Mark's Jesus or Matthew's or Mary's Jesus, that it's not so much the person as it is the community around which that. And there may not have been, I mean, Mary Magdalene, most of that, Jesus' disciples were illiterate. They didn't write anything. So it's just that simple. There, I mean, because number one, it's written in Koine Greek. It's not written in Aramaic. So, I mean, so there's a whole, but see, that doesn't diminish. It diminished for me maybe when I was 15, 20 years old, but it doesn't, it has a totally different meaning for me. And so depending on where our hooks are, we all get hooked.
Right.
So it's the community that's constructing who is Jesus. But more important than that, two statements, two qualifiers, if you will, I think have to be acknowledged, if not internalized. One of those is that human beings, by definition, are culturally conditioned and historically shaped, and therefore we espouse, we assume, we make assumptions, presuppositions about how the world operates. We have prejudgments about everything, which means that you and I are enculturated. By definition, culture creates this larger canopy within which you and I live so that we have the necessary practical social recipes to negotiate the world. So I don't have to really unlearn how to unlock my office door every time I want to come in. So cultures are necessary, but cultures are limited in the scope and the way in which, so we have to recognize whether it be Jesus's culture or Joseph Campbell's culture or our own cultures, that there are limits to those, and therefore the question becomes, are we willing to acknowledge that and recognize the bias that I bring to the reading or the conversation? So there's a limit on the human side. So that the technical term there is epistemology. But I think even more important than that is when we use terms like transcendence or that God term, what do we mean by that? And if the traditions, whether it be Jewish, Christian, Muslim, or any Buddhist, Hindu, recognize that when we start talking with this language, that it's poetic language, it's not prose, it's not fixed, it's dynamic, and it points to horizon. So the danger is that the human sees this language and codifies it, concretizes it, and it say that is God. That's what Christians do, because Christians want this belief structure around God. But I'm reminded Phyllis Tribble's Zen comment that when I point to the moon, or we could say the eclipse, the solar eclipse on Monday, I guess we shouldn't point to it, at least we have special glasses on. But when I point to the moon, do not confuse my finger with the moon, and worse, don't confuse that the finger is all that's there. And that's exactly what we do with text.
Yeah.
We assume the Bible is the Word of God, and that in some sense that then becomes inerrant, because we now attribute to this text all this connotation about God as the author, and therefore it's inerrant and infallible and all that. And I say, no. The text is a witness to the experience of human beings with what they understand to be at the depth dimension of life. And by definition, transcendence and depth means that it's more than what you and I can apprehend, let alone comprehend. So there, if we are serious about this depth dimension, this more or beyondness that we attribute to whatever the referent is, God, by definition, we can't exhaust it. It's the mysterious other. And therefore, there has to be distance between my language and the referent itself. I do not want to collapse it. I do not want to create an identity. So by definition, the object for Christians is not an object. It's a subject. It's a person, Jesus. And so we have to be careful about saying, I can absolutely know something or I'm certain about it, both in terms of what that subject is, but also in terms of the limit of the person who's doing the talking, the observing, the reading, the interpreting. So if we allow that kind of elasticity in there, initially that's frightening, because it means I cannot grasp it, I can't absolutize it, and worst of all, I can't own it. And if I can't own it, then I can't control it. And that's, I think, the inherent human problems. Calvin said, human beings are idol makers. Oh, yes, and God is the biggest idol we create. And then we take that idol and we beat the snot out of somebody who disagrees with us, right? Because right. That's the ultimate authority.
Yeah.
So your question is talking about what we call in scholarship hermeneutics, the art of interpretation. So we have to create these boundaries, if you will. We have to create these parameters, these criteria that recognizes the limits of what we can do, which then gives us the freedom, not to be, I would hope, shall we say, disrespectful, but actually I am respecting the text and I'm respecting the object, in this case the subject of the text, God or Jesus, because I recognize that I'm not an equivalent to them. We're not playing on a level playing field here.
Yeah.
And therefore, the key for Christianity, and I would argue for Judaism and Islam, although they don't use the words the same way, but faith is very different than belief. Faith is a personal, interrelational concept that has to do with experience, whereas belief is a cognitive second-order principle. So the very first time I dated my wife, I knew who she was because actually I met her in Synoptic Gospels class in seminary. But my roommate really knew her better than I did, so I went out on a date with her, came back, and so he asked me, well, how'd it go? Are you going to see her again? So the experience of this person I had firsthand. I came back, and then I began to process who she is and what does that experience mean to me as a human being.
Gotcha.
So they're two different. They're both required and necessary, but they're not the same thing. When you go to a movie and you start looking at your watch, the movie's over.
Right?
The experience,
right.
It's done.
Gotcha.
You've interfered. So that intimacy is gone. You're now self-consciously aware of the fact that you're doing this thing called watching a movie.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you for. I don't want to keep you too long. I feel like I've taken up a lot of your time, so I'm going to give you two final questions.
True and false, I hope.
kind of, in a sense, maybe not true and false, but I want these to be back of the napkin questions. So I want you to necessarily go with short incomplete answers here. So the first one is, and you kind of gave me a springboard to these when you were talking just then, but this podcast is largely concerned with people's perception of God. So I'm going to give you the big question. What, who, to the degree that you can explain it on the back of a napkin, what is God?
Oh, I can give you one more answer. My definition of God is, underscore, italics, and in quotations, inadequate.
Okay.
That's the first statement that I always want to make. And I say that sincerely, because whatever follows then is qualified. It's an approximation. It's my reflection upon the experience of what I mean by God. And so God for me is the lure which moves me into humanness.
Wow. That's incredible. That's... I wish
now
I...
Now the question is whether or not you think I'm human.
I'd say you qualify.
Okay.
So the next one is, I say this podcast is about God and it's about transcendence. Mm-hmm. So what, how do you transcend? What is transcendence for you? How do you engage in that state of being?
I don't think you don't orchestrate transcendence and you don't control it. So by definition, being human in the world creates moments that exceed my capacity both to quantify and to classify. So my wife and I just came back from a 3-week road trip to California to see our son, who turns 30 today.
Oh, wow.
And we stopped by national parks.
Wow. That was a pretty good moment.
Those were awesome moments. So that it's clear... It is clear that Paul Jones is not the center of the universe, because one, he was moving. but the point is that human beings are not the center of the universe. You and I reside at this intersection that we call the horizontal, that is history, and the vertical, the transcendent. That is, we can ask questions, the ultimate essential questions of life, to which we cannot, I cannot at least, compose what I would consider to be an absolute answer. So by definition, I can self-consciously and self-intentionally transcend my presentness by asking those questions, but they're unsatisfactory by definition. So the goal of a full human for me is to be able to live in the moment as eternal and transcendent and transparent.
I'd say that's a good place to stop. That's awesome.
All right.
I'm going to call you Paul because you asked me to, but all everything right. in me wants to call you Dr. Jones. But thank you so much for your time.
My
this
pleasure.
Has been fantastic. This is exactly what I was looking for.
Good.
Thank you very much.
Yes, sir.